Right now, you can get free carpet installation from the Home Depot. So while we're putting in your new carpet, you'll have more time to take care of the lawn, get started on dinner, or just lay down and relax on your new carpet after it's installed. Ah. Get your free carpet installation started with the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Minimum purchase of $4.99. Exclusions apply. U.S. only. See store for details.
Hey there, rock fans, and welcome to another episode of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, recorded just off Abbey Road here in northwest central London. And this week, we wanted to dive into yet another live album that was important for us growing up, me and Action Jackson. We met in college. At that point, we were both introduced to Iron Maiden, a band that we weren't familiar with only from their artwork, not as much from their music. But then once we were turned on to them, we never turned off. We've been big fans ever since. I've been to see them more than half a dozen times. We were supposed to see them together until I moved across the pond in 2019. But we hope that eventually we'll get live music back and we will get to see them together, if not in 2021, in 2022. At any rate, we may get off topic a little bit just because we love Iron Maiden so much, but we review the classic live album, Live After Death, which basically gives a good synopsis of their first five albums, but also shows the power and the fun that they brought to their live shows. It was accompanied by a video, VHS, and DVD, and that gave you a glimpse into the world of Iron Maiden and what you could get with a live show. It was a wonder. It was amazing that you could take so much gear, so much equipment, so much decoration, and a huge mascot with you on the road like that. So sit back and relax, listen to Action Jackson and me talk about Iron Maiden's classic, Live After Death, here on The Wolf.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I would like to go back in the Wayback Machine.
Wayback Machine.
To the year of 1990. This was probably like 93, 94, or something like that.
All right.
And I was having a conversation with this guy who was a just complete for lack of a better word.
Okay.
This was Mr. He was employed as a music professor at a school, and he specialized in rock and roll, and he knew everything.
Ah.
Okay, so we're having a conversation, and we're talking about bands, and I brought up Iron Maiden. He just dismissed them. I said, okay, but let me ask you a question. How many of these bands that you love so much can sell out, four nights at the Long Beach Arena in 1985 in front of what? So, say 80,000 people total, do a world tour. I think the problem is that Iron Maiden never got the love that they should have gotten / needed from the United States. All the rest of the world, absolutely. I think in the United States, they were almost like a hidden gem, because you figure, other than what, Run to the Hills and maybe Number of the Beast, like what other, and the Trooper, didn't get a lot of airplay on the in the United States. So when you found Iron Maiden, you were like, "What is this?"
I know.
Oh my goodness! They got so many out. Oh, this is great. How come I've never heard of these before? Well, my little secret is so cool. Let's keep going.
Yeah, American rock radio never gave them any respect. They never played them on classic rock. You'd have to be in a fairly big market, usually, with some kind of, not alternative rock, but big rock that's not just classic, that's not just the Beatles and the Stones and the Who, to get to these guys. And yeah, I mean, that same tour, they sold out Radio City Music Hall for 7 straight nights in 1985. And MTV never played them. They might play them on the Headbangers Ball after midnight. Was that on Saturday night, maybe? They might play them there, but they would never play them in regular rotation. Whereas, like in the UK, they would always get up into the charts. They would have them on Top of the Pops. They would have them, you know, on all sorts of different European TV shows and stuff like that. Whereas in America, it's like, no, we don't like that kind of stuff, or we're going to keep that down over here somewhere. And in fact, one of the times that I saw Iron Maiden with all 6 of them in the 2000s, Bruce was in a bit of a mood that day. And he said, you know what, fuck American radio, fuck MTV, we don't need them, you know, kind of thing. And he's even like, I don't know if it's like some high roller owns these seats down here, but there's no one sitting down here. Why don't you guys come on down here and sit here? Of course, some guys ran down there and security said, no, you're not in those seats. You have to move away.
I saw a thing about, this is a step to the left here, but I saw something about Billy Joel where he doesn't sell, that you cannot buy front row tickets to Billy Joel. Cannot do it. They're always empty. And what he does is he tells his road guys, go find the guys with the crappiest seats in the house and bring them down here. Because, yeah, he doesn't want to see rich people sitting there. Like you said, well, you know, I got this ticket, so I'll go. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I know a couple of Billy Joel. He wants, like, fans down in front. Because you're right. You got to feed off of that energy. If you've got people who are just, like, you know, looking at their phones or, you mm-hmm. know, whatever, it's like, ugh, I don't want this.
But going to 6, I mean, given the energy that you need for an Iron Maiden show and the stage that you generally have to cover, because they'll usually not only have a big flat part in front of the drum riser, but then they'll usually be a kind of on the same level as the drum riser. Usually that's Bruce's territory to run around up there and have props and wave flags and stuff like that and avoid pyro and things like that. But then there's plenty of space, you know, on the main floor there for all the other guys. And you could beef up a little rhythm there. And I mean, I've seen them. I honestly don't know how many times I've seen them because I don't have my tickets with me here. They're locked away in storage in the USA. But I must have seen them 6 or 7 times and never been disappointed. They always totally deliver. It's pretty amazing what they do, what they pull off, both visually and obviously for your ears. It's kind of incredible. And the fact that they deliver it over and over again like that is just a testament to kind of who they are and the ethos of Iron Maiden, from the band to the management to the crew, everybody involved.
But I think that goes back too to the conversation before about how if when you have the same guys like in your crew, mm-hmm. that must make it so much easier. You just know, I know these guys. I don't have to worry about the equipment. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about the sound. I don't have to worry about the lights. All these guys are rock solid. I just need to go out there and play, give them, you know, do what I need to do, and everything else will operate perfectly.
So how did you first hear or find Iron Maiden? Because for me, it was basically Emerson and then Roy Boy upstairs from us, from Miami, let me borrow Seventh Son and Power Slave.
I think for me, it was about the same time. I mean, I knew of Iron Maiden. Okay. Right. I knew who they were. I had heard a couple of songs, you know, like I said, Number of the Beast, Run to the Hills, Trooper. Okay, got that. But yeah, it was kind of that same where you started to get into it and you're like, I mean, I didn't even know anything off Seven Son until we started. I'm like, okay, all right. And then for me, the big one was Somewhere in Time. I love that record so much. And yeah, it was just the baffling of why aren't these people biggest band in the United States? I don't get it. It's fantastic. And they were built to play live. Everything sounds great. I like the fact that there's a uniformity to the covers. They mm-hmm. all, you know, Derek Riggs, all of covers up until I think Fear of the Dark.
Sounds
he
right.
did all of them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of here and there in between, he's done some, but they were all the same. They kind of all, and I like the fact too that if you start to really look at it, they all kind of build mm-hmm. on each other. Like the Somewhere in Time, you know, he's got the thing in his head from the brain surgery.
Right.
So it, yeah, and it just keeps building on and on. So it's like it's one big thing. Like they've thought about it ahead of time. Yeah, and that's that's when I really got into it and started to really get into the different tracks and the different. And then we started watching that the history of Iron Maiden. Mm-hmm. Somebody had that on VHS, and that was really cool. You know, they went through this whole tour and everything, and yeah, these guys have just been everywhere a million times.
Yeah, they just get out there and work. Live After Death was recorded at Long Beach kind of in the middle of a 190-plus date tour. Can you imagine 100 in a year in 20-plus countries? The stats that they put in the Live After Death booklet is like, we did nearly 100,000 miles, 7,800 hotel rooms, you know, like thousands of guitar strings, thousands of picks and drumsticks, 50,000 cans of beer. It's like unbelievable amount that it takes to take this all over the world.
I mean, what I've got here is it lasted 331 days, during which 187 concerts were performed. Oh. I mean, that's insane. That is insane to think of. It never ended. Because now, you know, they have, especially the big time people, like they'll go and they'll play, like Metallica will play, you know, a week on, week off, week on, week off. This was gone. We'll see ya. No, and this was before Ed Force One, so you're flying commercial, right?
You're on a bus, right? You know,
exactly.
Those, I mean, and now, of course, given their stature and given the fact that they're older and they need a little time to recuperate, it's hard to ask Bruce to sing back to back nights. It's hard to ask any big time singer to sing back to back nights these days. They did those 7 nights at Radio City Music Hall in 8 days. It's unbelievable. And same with Long Beach. Was it four? It's like 4 or 5 days. The stuff they got for the
all in a row.
Yeah, deluxe edition that came from Hammersmith Odeon the year before was also four days. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable how they just worked those guys. And for Bruce to be able to, I mean, he must have almost lost his mind. Forget losing your voice. That's hard to do. I mean, physically, it's hard to sing all that. Plus, you've got to run around and get the crowd going and do all that stuff that he does. And I got a feeling that once they did Seventh Son, and he had to sing Seventh Son of a Seventh Son every night, which is impossible to sing once, alone every night. Eventually he's like, okay, we have to space this out a little bit.
Well, my favorite, or one of my favorite things about this, I'm looking at the tour deal now. So the 7th of January, 1985, Buffalo, New York. The 11th, 1985, Rio de Janeiro. The 14th, Hartford, Connecticut. Right. I mean, that's, I mean, like you literally touch down, you do the show, you're back on the plane to South America, back, and then 14th. Oh, okay. So January 3rd, Cincinnati, 4th, Detroit, Columbus, Buffalo, Richfield, Buffalo, Rio, then back for Hartford, Worcester, and then your nights in New York City. I mean, that's insane. Anybody today would look at that and say, that's impossible. That's impossible to do.
And that was the first Rock in Rio that they ever played. And I think they were second under the bill of under Queen. Seeing Iron Maiden and Queen on the same bill has got to be a special treat.
300,000 of your closest friends.
Yeah, that's nuts, man. But yeah. And of course, that kind of set the stage for them to eventually go back and do some tours in South America. They really just did that one-off show in the middle of their big tour. But yeah, I mean, to do nearly 200 shows in a year. Plus, they went to places like Poland and brought the whole thing. A few bands during the Iron Curtain era did go play places like Poland, but they would bring kind of a stripped down equipment, not all the lights, not all the sound, maybe not even all your instruments. Just like, let's just play, bring what we need to play. But they brought the whole thing, the whole show, with the big sarcophagus behind them, and then Eddie coming out in his mummy wraps and all that kind of stuff. They did it everywhere. And that's what they need credit for as a stage show. You're not just seeing a band hop around. You're seeing the big backdrops. You're seeing the different eddies come on the stage. It's a lot of fun. And there's a lot of detail. And the stage is detailed because the people are, you know, high up and they're looking from far away. And you want to give them something to look at. And it's just respect that Maiden shows to their fans.
Yeah, they did a cool, I'm looking at this now, they did Poland and they did Yugoslavia. And I think they had something where it was like a a quick deal or a couple songs. It was Iron Maiden Behind the Iron Curtain. I'm like, oh, that was pretty cool. But yeah, to go to places, I'm sure they wanted to rip their faces off, because I'm pretty sure there wasn't a whole lot of entertainment going on in Yugoslavia in 1980. Not a lot of big acts coming through there at that point in time.
Yeah, no, and of course Yugoslavia got ripped up pretty bad in the following decade or two there. There's not much of a Yugoslavia left in a lot of Sarajevo got hit pretty hard.
Yeah, the Poland, we're in 1984, we're still talking about the Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure there was not a whole lot going on there behind the wall.
What's great, if you want to learn more about this era of Maiden, is, as we spoke about on the last show, there's an Early Days Part 2 that I think was probably made to become a DVD, just as Early Days Part 1 was. However, it was instead released on the Iron Maiden YouTube channel. And it's really just all about this time in creating Power Slave, doing that World Slavery tour, which about broke them, and then the Live After Death album, which was, you know, produced by Martin Birch, who we talked about on show number 13 about Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell, and Mob Rules. He basically did all the Maiden stuff up through Fear of the Dark. And he produced this, and he has a nice note in the liner notes of Live After Death. I think it was a Polish kid, or maybe somebody from behind the Iron Curtain said, you know, I really wish you could, I like heavy metal, but I like synthesizers. You should put synthesizers in the music. To which Bruce Fainley said, you can't put synthesizers in heavy metal. And then, after they get a little break from the road, there's some synths on, Somewhere in Time, and certainly on Seventh Son. Now, some of those are guitar synths, as in you get your guitar to sound like a synthesizer, but still, to me, that counts.
It's interesting, too, because I saw an interview with Bruce Dickinson. I can't remember what it was with Eddie Trunk, and he said something about Trunk's brought up, hey, you know, you guys have this, you know, resurgence. Would you ever think about doing a greatest hits tour? And Bruce looked at him, oh, never. Ever do a greatest hits tour. Well, they've done five or something right now. So, he's been wrong once or twice. And something that strikes you as not the best idea to begin with, let it sink in for a minute. Maybe he'll do that.
I know. It's like when he famously in that video that we watched so much on the history of that, where Bruce says, when he's doing the interview, he's like, look, I'm not like the other singer, and I'm not going to go get dressed up in all that leather gear. So if you don't like it, stuff it, right? And then they cut to him at Hammersmith Odeon, completely clad in leather, right, from like head to toe. Okay, Bruce, yeah, no, we hear you, buddy. But Bruce is obviously a very smart guy, not only the lead singer and a guy who's written a lot of lyrics for the band over the years, but is the pilot of Ed Force One, not just, you know, flying a little puddle jumper somewhere. He flies the 757 around the world, which you've got to believe, isn't being the lead singer like a big enough job or a stressful enough job?
I think he's a dude that's always like, what else can I be doing? Like, I don't think he's ever a guy who's like, you know what, I'm just going to take today off and take a nap. No, it's like, boom, we got to do something else. But it is disconcerting to see him in those videos wearing a standard issue, short sleeve, proper pilot outfit, like with the tie and everything, mm-hmm. and to hear him come on cockpit deal, because I mean it's registered as Flight 666,
right?
So Heathrow Tower, this is Flight 666 coming. What?
Yeah.
Although it's awesome too to see all the people, the things that people post, like they're at the airport and they have the camera out the window and you see Ed Force One pulling up to the. Oh, it's so awesome! It's a really cool looking plane.
It's an amazing plane. It's so cool, and I hope and assume that he gets a second paycheck for that, because obviously they would have to pay a pilot something to cart them around the world and make sure all those forms are right and all that. So I hope they pay him and don't just say, oh, well, the money we save, it kind of goes to all of us. They could be like, nah, I'll just go ahead and take my pilot's paycheck.
You want me to land this plane or do you want something bad to happen? Pay me my money.
Right. But I mean, he's got the legendary stories of him bringing somebody along or picking up people to give him fencing lessons before or after sound check or something like that. Like, is he fences? He could be just working on his voice. He could just be reading stories that would give him lyric ideas.
Nope. That's why I'm saying I think he's a dude that's like literally like, what else could I be doing today? I'm only doing four things. What's the fifth thing that I need to be doing today? Taking fencing lessons. It's an excellent idea. Thank you. Something that you could work into the state. Nah, I'm going to do something totally esoteric.
Well, he has written an autobiography, What Does This Button Do? I think is the name of it. which sounds about right for his personality. I've not read it, but that's one I definitely like to check out. I think that Adrian's recently put out a book on like fishing and his time in Iron Maiden, but it sounds like Bruce might have the real tome as far as what was it like to be in the band, in and out of the band, because he did have that solo career for about 7 years in the 90s, like you mentioned.
Yeah, but I think all these guys have to have it. And Nico is the world famous golfer. You got to have something else that you're doing, or you're going to go insane on something like this when you're traveling around the world. Because even though you figure, do the math, 331 days, 187 shows, that's still decent amount of downtime. So you got to have something else to do,
yeah,
or you're going to go crazy.
And you're going to be on a bus or a plane some of that time. I mean, you just have to be, right? You're going to have to be traveling some of that time. So when you get off the bus or the plane, what are you going to do? You know, you're just going to sit in the hotel room? Got to do something.
I would think too, like, it would have to be a deal where it's like, it's not that I don't love all you people, but I need to get away from you. Yeah, just go see the sights, play a little golf, you know, take a lesson, whatever. Just give me an afternoon just to relax, because I'm going to go insane. I mean, you figure how many other people, and I've got some friends here in the Navy that, you know, they're on for like, you know, 6 months and then they're off for a while. You think, well, that's pretty sweet. But when you're on, you're working every single day. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the same thing. Like, yeah, you're off, but I mean, you're not home. You're not with your family. You're not, you know, you don't have your stuff around you. You're in, well, let's see, I'm in France. I'm in Scotland. I'm in Canada. You know, you're just out in the middle of nowhere. But one thing that I thought was really cool about this record, when it came out, I remember seeing a copy of it, and it's in the book now, the little booklet you get. But this was, if I remember correctly, one of the sleeves that mm-hmm. the records were in. It has a daily crew work schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And this is insane. Basically, if you're on the crew, your rest time is the show. That's it. Like, it starts at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know, they go through the whole thing, and then 2 a.m. is finish loading trucks, shower in the buses, and travel to next show.
Right.
So basically you have in between traveling and then the show. And other than that, you're either putting it up, checking it, or taking it down.
Every it's day.
Nuts.
Yeah.
Every day. Every yeah. day. And I would guess, you know, you would actually look forward to the multiple day deals, because at least then it's like, okay, we get to rest and just kind
of
hang out.
Leave it up for a couple of nights, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. But I wonder too if, well, I know the Stones did it. Well, on the Steel Wheels tour, where they would have multiple sets. I don't think Maiden does that. I think they've got the one and it just travels with them.
I think that's right. Yeah, the Stones could probably afford to do the two or even three, maybe. But yeah, Maiden just has the one and they have their crew. And now they don't do many back-to-backs unless it's in the exact same place. So it's not the same anymore. But yeah, I mean, you get on the bus. And yeah, it's great when the bus takes off at 2. What if the bus doesn't take off till 3:30 because they had a hard time getting something out the back, or they were dealing with some kind of union jerks who, you know, decided to leave them? Because you have to pick up some help for unloading, you know, along the way. There's usually some local union guys that will come in and help you. What if they're having a strike at that point? You know, who knows? You know, so yeah, you're lucky if you get off at 2 in the morning, showered, and then, yeah, you can sleep a little bit on the bus if you're lucky.
Yeah, it's the deal of just how massive this thing really was, and how I have to go back and do a little research on this, but I don't know if anybody before this had taken up something so massive at one point in time. I know the bands had done, you know, tours of the world and, you know, played all different places, but to put it all together like this, I don't know. This might have been the first one.
To me, I mean, obviously there have been lots of bits and pieces for different shows, but I mean, this, again, the scale for the backdrops and then the big sarcophagus, then Eddie coming out of it like that and blasting the pyro out of his eyes. It's just really cool. And yeah, to take it, I mean, the stuff must have been pretty beat up at the end of that year, man. I mean, all those shows, all the running around, all the venues loading and unloading, it's got to take a wear on all that stuff.
And that's why I really, if it were me, and I've spent time thinking about this, obviously, because I love this, but if it were me and I were a Steve Harris or a Dave Murray or something, somebody like that, I think I would just have guitars that's all they were there for. That's it, to just get beat up on tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy to me when people say, oh yeah, this is my number one, it's a 65 Les Paul. Are you crazy? Don't let that out of your, I wouldn't let that go anywhere. I would keep it with me, and yeah, I'd have someone that I got last week that I could just beat up and if anything happens, whatever, I don't care. Just, yeah, the amount of wear and tear this stuff takes, it's got to be. And plus, you're sweating all over it every night,
right?
All in the electronics, that the amount of time that the techs would have to do on it, like pretty much, you know, how many times would you have to rebuild these things during the tour? Either, you know, take all the electronics apart and clean them out, or redo it, knobs and everything. I think famously for Eddie Van Halen, they were saying that he would literally melt the things. Like the knobs would just be, he would just beat them into the ground because they play so hard on these things. 3 hours a night, every night, not built for that.
Crazy, yeah. No, they must come out on tour with dozens, and now, especially now that they have three lead guitarists, they must go out on tour with dozens and dozens of guitars. Even if you're only playing 15 songs in a night, which I think I saw them once where they only did 13 songs. If your average song is 8 or 10 minutes long, you don't do 25 songs like the Stones might. You know, you have a kind of what it seems like a brief. You're like, oh, they only did 13 songs. Like, yeah, that's 1 hour and 45 minutes though, man. That's what it is. And then all three of them playing, they don't necessarily switch after every song, but yeah, a lot of the guitars have different strings or they have different tone, which is different for each song. So you got to switch those out and have them at the ready. Plus, what if you bust a string? You got to have a backup ready in that tone, in that string gauge to run right out there in case that happens, you know? So the number of guitars backstage must be sick.
Yeah, and I would imagine that each person has their own tech, because I can't imagine with that, there's just no way you could keep track of more than one thing. And then you got to make sure that wireless works 100%. We have a backup to that, a backup to the backup, because once the thing starts, you can't, oh, hang on a minute, folks, we're having technical difficulties. It just has to run smooth. And that's a weird deal too, because I saw something, it wasn't for this tour, but it was one of the, like the Flight 666 or Book of the Souls tour, is that, I mean, you go to Europe, cool. You go to the United States, North America, you get down there to South America, some of those places, the power might not be
quite
100%.
Yeah.
Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. What are we looking at? What's going on, because these guys need a lot of juice to power this thing. This is not your standard plug one thing in.
Right.
So yeah, when you get down there, it's that we need to just definitely triple check to make sure that everything's going to work.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what like Smallwood and the management guys do for years, right? It's another part of Iron Maiden's success is their only manager they've ever had is Rod Smallwood, man. For 43 or something like that years, before they got signed, he was the manager of Iron Maiden and has always been their manager. And created some Sanctuary Records and created some businesses, but has always been so good to them. He's like, look, I'm going to give you money. It's not like I'm going to give you a check and then you're going to owe a bunch of taxes. So if you go out and spend it all, then suddenly you're in tax hell, right? When I give you your money, it's going to be done. You know, you can go out and buy a car. You can go out and buy a house, you know, and set them up with houses for their folks if that's what they wanted. Just seems like a really sharp businessman, but obviously a cool guy because he hangs out with the Maiden guys, has managed other bands, has made the record company that handles their business and stuff. It's pretty top-notch. And then Andy Taylor, who's, I think, kind of old school British guy, like, you know, went to a good school and wears suits and ties every day, but he's always been, you know, their business guy all these years, for 40 plus years. It's amazing.
Yeah. They found a recipe that works. They've stuck to it. And yeah, how many other bands can you say? I mean, what did the first record come out? 1980
was Iron Maiden. 81 was Killers. Yeah.
It works. Why mess with it? And I think the other thing too is, you know, you were talking about when Bruce left and he is playing smaller venues and the band is playing smaller venues and they both decide, you know, together, yes, separately, not so much. And Bruce swears up and down that he didn't say anything to them until Blaze wanted out. I think Blaze didn't really understand what he was getting himself into as far as the, you know, commitment to Iron Maiden and the fans, but definitely, I mean, I think he did a great job, Blaze. I think his voice sounded great on those records. It just doesn't work without Bruce. Sorry.
I agree. And they did some good stuff. Man on the Edge, Klansman, Silence of the Cross. They did some good songs.
The World's Hands is a good track, too.
Yeah,
like
they did some
one.
Good songs with Blaze in there. And the Klansman is one that I've seen them do live that I think is fantastic. It's a great Maiden song. It talks about, you know, William Wallace and his fight for Scotland's freedom. You're right. I mean, Bruce Dickinson made Iron Maiden so much better. Paul Di'Anno is kind of more of a punk singer, in my opinion.
For the first two records, he worked very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
Very well. And but then they needed to go, you know, it's like this, the Saturn rockets going up in outer space and you kind of jettison parts. I mean, they needed something else to take them to the next level. And the something else was Bruce Dickinson. They could not have been the band that they are with Paul. And I think, I mean, he's probably still bitter to this day. I don't know him personally, but you can't. You just couldn't have done it. I'm sorry, buddy. You didn't have the songwriting. You didn't have the vocal chops. You didn't have the front man persona that Bruce has. You have to have all of those things.
Yeah, I was going to say the charisma. He definitely has a charisma, but it's not the same kind that Bruce Dickinson had. He, besides just the talent and power in his voice, the way he connects with an audience and entertains them going around the stage is pretty amazing. It's kind of unequaled. He's a pretty special character.
Yeah, and you need him, especially now, to do, he has to go on, you know, Good Morning Britain or whatever they have at these things, do these interviews, what it sounds like the rest of the guys don't really want to do that. Like, Steve Harris doesn't seem like, I mean, he's a great musician, he writes great songs, but he doesn't seem like the dude that's like, let me tell you all about me. It's kind of like, he seems like a very shy, reserved guy. So you need that person that's like, hey, I'll take this one. Let me tell you about all we're doing now and how great this is. And it's cool. I mean, he does other cool things too. I watched a documentary that he did about the history of aviation because he's a big, and it's just like, yeah, I'll sit here and watch this because this is fantastic. Because
he's an entertainer.
Yes, correct, correct.
He's an MC, right? Yeah. He's a master of ceremonies.
And unfortunately for Paul Di'Anno, there are bands where the new guy can sing the old stuff, like a Sammy Hagar, but it doesn't sound exactly the same. And you're like, well, this is Dickinson. When he sings Wrathchild, when he sings, you know, the old stuff, it's like, nah, it's pretty good too. Like, he's just got that voice. He's got the voice of Iron Maiden. It's you can go there and you don't want for anything. You don't say, well, it doesn't sound that. Sound pretty good.
It sounds, yeah, it might sound better.
And he can sing the Blaze stuff too. It's like, yeah, it's,
yeah, his talent is superior. And, you know, played Iron Maiden basically every night of their lives, right? They've never not played Iron Maiden. And Bruce doing Iron Maiden, he puts in, you know, Scream for Me Long Beach, you know, that's so cool, man. I'm serious. I get so jazzed hearing that. Scream. And he does it once to get him to shout, then he'll do it one more time, Scream for Me Long Beach, because they know they're going to go into the really gallop or the solo part of the song that's going to drive everybody nuts. It's like, let's get everybody on their feet screaming. God, it's a lot of fun, man. Now, what's your favorite song? I mean, we can go through here song by song, but to me, the highlights are kind of Hallowed Be Thy Name, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, because it's really long. I like starting off with Aces High and 2 Minutes to Midnight. 2 Minutes to Midnight, is it The Trooper? I think it was The Trooper was the one that I thought was maybe not their best version. Not that it's bad, but maybe I've heard them do Trooper better. Otherwise, I think all of these are awesome live. They captured it. But The Trooper might have been like, yeah, maybe they could have done that one better.
Yeah, and when they've done a couple of, well, not a couple, they've done a decent amount of live recordings after this.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is always the gold standard.
Absolutely. And
yeah, that did seem a little, not off, but like, yeah, I've heard him do it better. Yeah, Rime of the Ancient Mariner is cool because it's 13 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
I always love Number of the Beast because the way it starts, and then they add in the drums, and then he does the scream. That's pretty cool. I really like the intro deal with Churchill too, because you feel like if you really listen to that, you're like, yeah, I can see how he got everybody jazzed. And then I don't know, I'd have to go back and look. I know that later on, they do the same. I mean, they've done that for years, the Churchill speech into Aces High. I don't know if they did the pre-recorded deal on this one, because the beginning, I've seen it later, it's pre-recorded.
Mm-hmm.
The first intro part, and then that's live.
Yeah.
So they have the intro, they have the planes flying, mm-hmm. they do that, and then they come running out. They have the pre-recorded part to kind of get themselves ready to run out on stage and do that. So that's kind of cool. And then, you know, right into 2 Minutes to Midnight, which is, that was the big song from Power Slave. So that was the big hit. I mean, you figure a lot of people, especially United States, that's what they were that's what they were there for.
Right, right. They made the video. I think it's a killer song. I think it's a lot of fun, the 2 minutes to Midnight song. But yeah, no, the Churchill speech is famous. In fact, when Gary Oldman, who won an Oscar for playing Winston Churchill in Our Darkest Hour, at the end of the movie, he delivers that speech to Parliament, and I know it. I know that part of the speech, and I'm saying it. My wife and I, I'm like, we shall fight in the hills, shall fight in the streets, for growing power and confidence in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. She's like, how do you know this? And I'm kind of like, come on, Oldman, you got to deliver it with a little bit more. I know how this is supposed to sound, man. You must know too. Either if you haven't heard Iron Maiden, you've at least listened to him give this speech. You know, come on, man, you got to give it what it's worth.
And I think it's cool that then they go into Power Slave, which was the other big one off of that. And Remember the Ancient Mariner was off of Power Slave. So they do. Mm-hmm. And that's always been one of their hallmarks, too. If they've got a new record, they play a decent amount of it, which is cool. That Hallowed Be Thy Name, that's cool and old.
Amazing.
Iron Maiden, again, back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And I think that closes the show, or it stops, and then they come back for the encore of Run to the Hills and Running Free.
Yeah.
Now, on the video, they played Sanctuary on the original video, VHS or DVD, whatever. They played Sanctuary, and Bruce holds that note. Sanctuary from the law. He holds that law note. It's like for 4 or 5 minutes, man. It's just in her law. It's unbelievable how long he does that. But it never appeared on the original Live After Death, nor on any of the re-releases that I've ever seen.
What I'm looking at here, it says it was on the 1995 reissue bonus disc. But yeah, that was from Long Beach too. But yeah, that just goes to prove that the dude can sing. For all the hard rock metal bands out there that, you know, the guy was like, well, he kind of just yelled along to the thing. No. The difference in Iron Maiden is that he was definitely a vocalist. He can really sing. Mm-hmm. And with something like this, over and over and over again. And to this day, still, I mean, I know he's older now, but I mean, still pretty good in the vocals.
Still belting it out. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. I mean, look, Live After Death introduced a lot of people to Iron Maiden. Obviously, the tour was a first for a lot of people to see Iron Maiden in the States because they did so many dates in so many venues. They went to a lot of smaller places. I mean, it doesn't shock you that they played Nashville, but does it surprise you they played Johnson City, Tennessee, which is not a very big market, you know? They didn't play just the big cities. They went to some smaller spots and really turned some people on. And so then this was, with the absence of a greatest hits, this is a way to get people into, like, here's some of our best. Yes, it's live, but here's some of our best put together. So it's a good introduction as well. Maybe you can't go buy the first 5 or 6 Iron Maiden albums, but you could get this, get an introduction to it, and then kind of work your way from there. And so that's kind of what it served as to me, because Ace's Eye, 2 Minutes to Midnight, Trooper, Revelations, Flight of Icarus, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Power Slave, Number of the Beast, Hallowed Be Thy Name, and then Iron Maiden, Run to the Hills, and Running Free. It's not the whole show, but it's a good primer for getting you to understand what Iron Maiden's about, and then you've got the opportunity to explore further.
So I think that in a lot of ways, this was a lot like Kiss Alive, where I would imagine that probably a lot of people back then had said, yeah, kind of, I'd heard about them before, but then you get this record and you say, oh man, this is a whole deal. I'm really, if you didn't go to the show, and you picked up Live After Death, I can imagine in 1985 you said, well, I missed out on something here because this sounds fantastic. And I don't know, I can't tell you, and they'll probably never tell me, how much of this was really live and did you go back and clean it up, or I don't know. But it sounds fantastic to me.
Yeah, and that's part of the early days, Volume 2. Harry went back to the truck because they had the mobile studio back there for those 4 nights. And he went back to listen to it. It's like, well, what's it like? And he's like, wow, it really does sound good. You know, and Martin Birch talks in the booklet here about how he went out to find good new mics, because the mics you use to record a live album are a little different than the ones you take out on the road to get knocked around for a whole year. So we got some good special mics so everybody would sound really good, and they put them in all the right spots around the stage. And that contributes to it.
And I think it helped too that they had 4 nights there to get it, you know, to get everything that they wanted to. If they needed to, you know, pick and choose, or if something sounded a little wonky, they could fix it for the next one. So I think it's a cool, I think most people do that, but I don't know if most people would take 4 shows to do it.
Usually it's two.
You may only have two.
Yeah. Usually it's two. And here's the thing, bud. I mean, because they filmed it too, right? And I don't know if they filmed every single night, but if you do film every night, you got to wear the same thing every night for four nights, right?
Correct.
So you got to get those washed in between shows. And it's one thing if the Stones wear the same thing for two nights. They can burn the stuff every night and just buy them brand new the next day. It doesn't matter. Those guys are rich, right? But Maiden's probably like, yeah, okay, well, I gotta wear the same thing every night. Let's wash them in between nights, huh?
And the thing is, if you see, I mean, I love the Stones, but if you see them after the show and you see Iron Maiden after the show, they are just like drowned rats.
Yeah,
they're just sweaty and beat up. And yeah, that's you got to really do some work on those clothes to get them.
No, you got to peel yourself out of those. Usually you see them, Gary. They've got robes on and they get in the van to get them the heck out of there. In a robe, they're not wearing their clothes, you know, because that stuff's going to stink and stick to you. You got to get out of that, put on a robe, and then you get in the van, right?
I think that most of these guys, at this point in time, the giant bands like Metallica, everybody else, they just don't want to do it anymore. It's too mm-hmm. physically taxing, especially Metallica. They figured out, listen, if we go on a big tour, we are not going to be married anymore. Yeah. That's just not going to happen. So we need to make everybody happy. And I think they found a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. But in 1985, you just didn't have that.
No.
You didn't have that flexibility. You didn't have that option. And I think they just said, we're going to do what it takes to be the biggest band in the world. And if it takes 300 days on the road and 197 shows, that's what we're going to do.
And that's what they did. God love them. And hey, they may have lost touch with their wives and kids, but they built the foundation for them to be able to do whatever they want. And they do now, you know, it's great that Metallica can play 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. They're super rich. And if they want to hang out with their kids, God bless them. I'm glad they do. I'm sure their kids are glad about it too.
But, you know, to their credit, in 1991, they spent 2.5 years on the road. And so they put their, and I think the deal on that was every single person who was married at the beginning was not by the end of the tour, and just decided, you know what, that probably wasn't the best idea in hindsight.
You can't play 2.5 years the same tour, man. It's sick. I mean, I'm glad because we saw them on that tour and it was
correct.
And it was, but also the way they toured, no opening act, 3 hours and 20 minutes of that heavy metal every night. My goodness, man, they are some bad dudes for pulling that off.
I think they're the same way though. They're built to play live. They record records with the express purpose of playing it live. So when they were younger, yes, mm-hmm. that's something that they could do. But yeah, I think now they figured either they're going to be dead from exhaustion or they're going to have, you know, all kinds of family problems. But yeah, it's just I don't know. I think at some points, like, you hate it, but you love it at the same time.
Yeah, well, I mean, a band like Metallica, they don't need to tour for money anymore. They're set. They have all the cash. Yes, they take the money they make, but if they, for some reason, could never tour again, could never record anything new again, their lives would still be pretty well set. So if you're going to do it in a way that makes sense for you. Do it in a way that makes it still fun. Don't go out for 8 straight months. 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, then you go back out. That's, if you can pull it. Now, most bands can't do that, right? That would be too expensive. It'd be too hard. Too much would happen in the 2 weeks off that would create problems. But you're Metallica. You're kind of special, and you've earned it at this point.
Yeah. These multi-zillion dollar tours, they're kind of a thing of the past now. I mean, even the – I don't know of anybody – I was trying to think about that going into the show. Who today could do something like that, even if they wanted to? I don't really think there's that many people that could tour the world.
From a rock band? I mean, yeah. Yeah, there might be. I mean, maybe Taylor Swift could do it.
Right, but like a hard rock band? I know the Foo Fighters are pretty big, but, you know, could they go to, like, could they go to South America? I don't know.
There aren't many left, and that's why we cling so tightly to the bands that we still do have. And that's why I always support Iron Maiden. I don't always love the new albums when they come out. I usually don't listen to them over and over the way we used to listen to Seventh Son and Somewhere in Time back in the day. But I always buy them and I always go see them live because I want to support them because they've done so much for us as fans over the years they've earned my respect and they've earned my dollars. That's for sure.
So that brings up another point, maybe, that mm-hmm. we had tickets to see them. In, what was it, Cincinnati? And then you moved across the pond.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is that when we come out of this horrendous deal, we've got to figure out a way to save them. We have to figure out a way to do this.
Absolutely. And I know that Iron Maiden is dying to play. And they had the whole tour in Europe. I did have tickets to see them in the Netherlands last summer, which of course got postponed, and I got a feeling it's going to be either canceled outright or postponed and rescheduled again. Yeah. Because some of the shows that I was going to see this year have already decided to just say, no, we're not going to do it. The Who are not playing. They'll probably try to do some other tour in the future when it's possible, but they just, instead of postponing and rescheduling again, they just canceled. They said, nope, we're not going to do it. Iron Maiden delivers, and they want to play every show that they've booked. And if they can't, they'll get to it eventually. And you know that even if they weren't going to play London or the UK, Gary, that once all this gets resolved, and it might be 2022, but they'll come do a big gig in the UK. I'll assume it's like a Wembley type, but maybe they go to Cardiff or something like that. Who knows? But I'll get you over here for that.
That would be fantastic. And I mean, if they, like, really the cool thing would be is if they played like a Donington or something like that, mm-hmm. that would be just outrageous. But yeah, we gotta make it happen because that might be the last time. I don't know. I mean, everybody's getting older. I don't know what the deal is. Got to make it happen.
And to your point, when you said, well, they said they never do a greatest hits tour. Now they've done a lot of them. Their schedule over the last 20-ish years has been like, we tour on the new album and we do a lot of the new stuff. Then we'll do a tour and we'll kind of do greatest hits. And then, you know, next time we'll do new album with newer stuff, because they've won over a lot of fans the last 20, 25 years who don't just want to hear the stuff from Live After Death era like we do. They want to hear the newer stuff, like from Brave New World and Matter of Life or Death and all that kind of thing. So they realize there's different fans. There's the older ones, and then there's the younger generation. So the tours kind of skip back and forth. Well, now they're kind of in the midst of, you could say, a greatest hits tour.
Legacy of the Point.
Legacy of the Beast. Yeah, they're in the midst of the Legacy of the Beast tour, which was, they put out an album at the end of the last year, Knights of the Dead, Legacy of the Beast, live in Mexico, which again, they recorded over a few different nights there. We were going to review that. In all honesty, we were thinking we were going to review the new album and be contemporary. And then we realized we're just going to be comparing it to Live After Death anyway.
Correct.
You know, what's it matter? Correct. We've got a lot more to say about Live After Death than this album that's just come out. And it's a double discer. It's like, how many times am I going to listen to it? Because I've already got the experience of hearing Live After Death dozens of times, right? It's a lot more to draw on than I'm just hearing this. And it's good, not as good as Live, but you know, right?
Yeah, you can't, any song that's on Live After Death on any other record, you're always going to be comparing it. That's just how it's going to go. That's because right. This was the first, this was the big one. And then, like we said, I think this was one of the first records that got us into the band. So it's hard to compete with that.
And those first five records are the foundation of the band, right?
Yeah.
And so this will always be a classic. And especially people our age, which helped us find Iron Maiden and fall in love with Iron Maiden, this is always going to be a special one. And yeah, they're in the midst of this Legacy of the Beast, so when they pick back up, they could change things around. Obviously, they could switch out some different songs, but they should still be in Greatest Hits Legacy mode, and that is a lot of fun.
And going back to my conversation I talked about at the beginning, I really think that anybody who dismisses this band is that you really don't know what you're talking about. If you sat there and listened to it and took in all of the years that they've put in making records, playing the fans, touring the world, this is, I still go back to think, how are they not bigger than the United States? It's just, it's almost like a secret. Like, you know, okay, if you don't know, you don't know. But yeah, if you were to listen to these records, you would say, no, these guys rule. This is fantastic.
Well, I find most people who don't like Iron Maiden, they just don't like heavy metal outright. Like, oh, that's in the heavy metal box. Well, that's a box I don't like. Keep it away from me. Or they haven't really heard them, and they look at the album art and say, oh, that's not something my wife and I will sit down and listen to. I don't want to listen to that. You know, that's like one of those bands I don't like. But people who like hard rock and Van Halen and stuff like that, Def Leppard, it's not the same thing. No, it doesn't have the harmonies and stuff like that. It's got some really shredding guitar, but it's not mindless shredding. It's melodic and it makes sense within the songs. And yeah, some of the lyrics, it's heavy stuff. It's not for little kids, maybe, but it's an amazing heavy metal, man. And it's still my favorite.
I think you're right. And there really isn't, I'm trying to think of all the records that they've put out. I mean, some of the newer stuff, I think I probably haven't listened to enough to really get into, but like pretty much from the beginning up to Seventh Son, I mean, it's not really, there aren't really any low spots.
No, everything they did in the 80s is fantastic. Everything they did in the 80s is fantastic.
Yeah.
I didn't like No Prayer for the Dying very much, but then they followed that up with Fear in the Dark, and they always play Fear in the Dark. They kind of have to, you know, it's a huge song for them. Some lineup changes in the 90s, you know, so some of the Blaze songs aren't the same, but some of those are still great. There's always something good off of every album. It's just they really extend them out these days, and with three guitar players who each get a turn and then maybe each get two turns, well, yeah, now it's suddenly a 9-minute song, right?
Yeah. And I wonder too how they do that. I mean, they must have gone in and just reworked parts from the older stuff without the three guitars. You know, you just put in something on top. On paper, that shouldn't work out, but it does. How do you have three lead guitars? Well, watch, because they do it. And it looks like they all pretty much get along. They all know, you know, what parts they're playing. When is their time to shine? When is their time to take a step back?
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that I always loved about Maiden is that even with two guitars, you think, well, the bass is going to get pushed back. Not with Steve Harris. He's right. Driving the bus. The bass is fantastic. He, like we talked about before, he is Iron Maiden. And then a guy who Tommy Lee describes as an octopus, Nico, in the back. And I remember I heard a song, and I can't remember which one it was. I don't remember what it was, but it was Bruce in his solo years playing the song. And I just thought to myself, that is not the same without Nico. It's not the same without him. These little things that he puts in, the little fills, the sidebars that he does. Everybody in that band is a top-notch musician.
Top-notch.
And they all know how to play well together. There's a ton of bands where you're like, oh, well, there's a good band, but so-and-so's they're really the star. I don't think there's really a star of the band. They all work together well.
If there's a star, I mean, I guess I would say it's Steve Harris. But, I mean, Bruce Dickinson, because of the way he commands the stage and runs everywhere, and he's obviously a star. But then you got Dave Murray, kind of quiet back there, and an amazing composer of solos and songs. And then you got Adrian, someone to me who plays with maybe a little bit more heart. For me, Dave is a little more cerebral, whereas Adrian can play with a little more chutzpah, although still up and down the neck and plays amazing stuff. He can maybe bend and pull a little bit more, whereas Dave's more about more notes sometimes. I don't know. They definitely have different tones, but their tones even each other out, and I like it.
Then you throw Yannick on top of that, and he's the guy who's, you know, throwing the guitar around, you know, swinging it around, and he's playing, you know, he puts his hand, you know, instead of the thumb underneath on top, and he's
that Rudy Sarzo bass style, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's fun. He's entertaining. He's having fun up there, you know?
Yeah.
And he does take a little bit of a back seat on some of the older songs. They might give him, you know, a place to play on, but sometimes like, okay, I didn't really play on this, you guys did, so I'll just sit there and strum some chords and lay a little bit of extra background, but it gives him a chance to hop around, and he's being a showman, putting his hand in different places, always wearing the Iron Maiden t-shirt with no sleeves, man, every single gig.
But so I think you take, so again, on paper it shouldn't work out, but they make it work out between them, you know, throwing the solos back and forth. And then, you know, you have, like I said, Steve Harris driving the bus. Mm-hmm. The Iron Maiden would not be Iron Maiden without the Steve Harris gallop.
That's right.
How it goes. You know what it is. And, you know, and he writes the majority of the songs. There are, you know, there are ones that he doesn't, obviously, but main kind of creative force there.
Well, that wraps up our episode on Iron Maiden and their classic 1985 live album, Live After Death. Hey, did we miss the point? Did we get something wrong? Did we get something right? Is there a band or an album you really want us to review? Let us know. Reach out to us at Twitter at @ugly_werewolf. And check out all our past episodes at uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com. Until next time, rock and rollers, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.